Well, good morning to all. It's a blessing to be able to come together and see one another, but more importantly, together in God's name and during this period to open up His Word. And we are still studying in Ecclesiastes. And this morning, our attention goes to chapter 6 and 7. So if you turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 6, we will venture into those chapters this morning. Chapter 6 is a little shorter. We're going to do 6 and 7. 6 actually is sort of a recycling of some things we've already seen, and then we'll look at chapter 7. So it's great to be together. Let's start with a prayer. And Earl, would you lead our thoughts, please?
Our Father, our God, we are grateful to you for all the blessings that are ours through your Son, Jesus. We're grateful for this hour, for this place, this opportunity to be here. We pray that you would be with us as we study from Ecclesiastes and help us, Father, to glean from it the things that you intended for us to understand and know. And we pray that that understanding would be enriched and help us to be drawn closer to you and help us to live lives that honor you and benefit us and prepare us for eternity with you. In Jesus' name.
Amen. So as the wise preacher who writes Ecclesiastes is trying to understand the meaning of life, what's his conclusion over and over? Vanity, empty, futile, uselessness. This is his conclusion over and over and over, and he's going to continue to make that conclusion in chapter 6 especially. But as we move into chapter 7, we see very clearly the distinction in these middle and latter chapters of the book where he shares wisdom with us. So in spite of the reality of the emptiness of life, there is still wisdom to use in it. And that's where we'll end up in chapter 7. So why would you say also, at this point, why would we listen to this man's counsel? What have you seen about this man that would cause you to listen to him? Been there, done it all, hasn't he? Yes. And he's objective. They're even about himself. I think that you're exactly right, that you sense in this man, he's very frank about everything and fair about everything, and he's not trying to play favorites or spin anything at all. Yeah, right. So if his conclusion is that there's all this emptiness to life, it's not like he's a guy who's been a total failure from an earthly standpoint. So there is this legitimacy to him being such a success in so many things, but then making that conclusion. You know what? You know what this should cause us to do? I don't know. I just think this is a wise thing. We should be suspicious of the successful movers and shakers who sell us a bill of goods. The people who, Frank was talking about the other day about the billionaires who are having the space race, okay? The big, powerful, wealthy, mighty people who get up and proclaim life's great, you just got to dream big and work hard and you can be like me, I think we ought to be cautious whether we should believe them or not. In light of what this man is saying, I don't know if we should put that much stock in what they're saying. Because oftentimes when you look at their lives, it's like this life. It's filled with a lot of woes and emptiness. And occasionally you hear someone who's incredibly successful and they commit suicide and people are shocked. It's like they're at the top of their craft. They're this great actor or musician or business person. It's like, oh, well, you read Ecclesiastes and you understand. All right, so let's look at chapter 6 and start with verses 1 and 2. Daryl, can you read those verses, please?
There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is prevalent among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that his soul lacks nothing of all that he desires. But God has not empowered him to eat from them, for a foreigner enjoys them. This is vanity and a severe affliction.
All right, thank you. We're seeing in this book some cycling of some themes, much like James. Remember James? He kept cycling through some of the same things, like, you know, the power of the tongue and so forth. James is more, I guess you could say, crafty. He's more creative in how he brings up the same thing. The writer of Ecclesiastes certainly has this literary finesse about him, but when he brings up the same things, it's like a sledgehammer. He just keeps bang, bang, bang. It's not quite as creative when he brings up the same subject again. There's a lot of repetition to it. And here, once again, we see his reference to the elusiveness of wealth and accomplishments, and we were just talking about that. So, again, what I've seen under the sun, he keeps drawing us back to that. That this is earthly life purely from this perspective, not a heavenly perspective. He'll throw in the heavenly perspective, the divine perspective, but this is what he's seeing on earth, okay? And what he sees is, here's a man who has wealth and possessions and honor, but yet, he says, it's an evil. Why? Why is it this evil experience of wealth and possessions? What's happening in verse 1, or verse 2, rather? Somebody else is enjoying it. This man is really not enjoying it. So let's understand this expression, evil, here. In this context, what does evil mean? Are we talking about moral evil necessarily?
Kind of unjust, unfair.
That's right. A burden, something that's not right, something that's unfair. Probably one of the most quoted parts of the book of Ecclesiastes, he's going to use this term evil at the end of the book, and he's going to describe what is evil. Chapter 12, getting what? What days?
Old.
Okay. The evil days. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth before the evil days come. That doesn't mean as you get older, your life's going to be filled with wickedness. Not that kind of evil. But rather, it's the idea of something that's bad. Something you don't want. Something that is burdensome. And so it is here. Yeah.
Well, back in verse 19, he's talking about a man who's rich and wealthy. And God does empower him to enjoy his stuff. But this guy is not empowered to enjoy his.
Okay. There, don't let the chapter divisions throw you off. That is a really good setup. Watch how these sections connect each other. There's an interconnectivity. And so there's a contrast there. So what's the problem? We can sort of answer that from verse 18 to 20. This man has possessions, but it's an evil experience. Why? Again? Somebody else is enjoying them and he's not enjoying them. And according to verses 18 to 20, how do you actually enjoy your life on earth and your possessions?
It's all perspective.
All about perspective. And what does he keep saying? What has God done back in verse 18, 19, and 20 about these things? God gave them to you. If you look at the things you have and the life you have as God-given, it's a different perspective. And there is the secret to enjoying those things. This is all God-given. But if you take God out of the equation, it's empty. No matter how much you have, it's empty. So that's what's going on here. It's a good linkage there. He talks about this person has possessions, but somebody else enjoys them. You know, there's a couple ways that could happen. He may have lost things he had. Remember back in chapter 5, verse 14, the man who had wealth, but he lost it in a bad investment. So it may be that he had possessions, didn't enjoy them, and then lost them, or that he just died. Because we know back in chapter 2, he talks about the idea that I've built all this up, but I've got to leave it to someone who may be a fool. So either way, he doesn't keep it, okay? So there's that elusiveness of wealth and accomplishments. It's just, you think it's going to be so satisfying, and it's always beyond your reach. He keeps talking about that. Look what he writes about next, verse 3 to 6. Tristan, will you read verse 3 to 6, please?
If a man begets 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he, for it comes in vanity and departs in weakness, and its name is covered with darkness. Though it has not seen the sun or known anything, this has more rest than that man. Even if he lives 1,000 years twice, but has not seen goodness, do not all go to one place.
All right, thank you.
Now, he's already talked about, in verse 1 and 2, about a scenario of a man who had great possessions. And he also describes him as having also honor, okay? Starting in verse 3, here's a scenario of a man, if a man, who has other signs that the world would say, wow, your life's been a success. What are they? Possessions back in verse 1 and 2. What does he talk about in verse 3? Many children and a long life, many years. And we could say ancient times or really any time. If a person has possessions and wealth and honor and long life and a lot of family, a lot of children, then somebody would say, wow, that man's had a great, full, successful life. But this is depicting a person that's not. Doesn't mean you can't have an enjoyable life with those things, because he is describing that that's possible. But he's saying that, look how this doesn't make sense. Why is it that there are people who have all this stuff, but they're not satisfying? That's the nagging question that he keeps coming up with, okay? Now, according to what we saw, Earl pointed this out at the end of chapter 5, it says he has 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years, verse 3, are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things or with life's goodness. He's still not enjoying it, okay? Now, again, according to chapter 5, as well as some earlier statements, how do you enjoy life's good things?
Recognize you're not going to find ultimate fulfillment, first of all.
Two consistent messages in this book. One is those things are from God. Second of all, don't expect those things to satisfy you permanently. Aren't those the two things he keeps saying in this book over and over? Possessions, they're from God, see them as a gift, but don't expect them to satisfy you completely. So you're going to go eat lunch later today, probably. And you may enjoy that lunch, and you should. But how long will it fill you up? Okay? Matter of hours. I mean, if you have a big lunch, you may hold off not anything till breakfast the next morning. But probably not. Okay? I'm looking at a few people that I'm thinking, you know, Tristan's a young man. He probably has to eat on a regular basis, okay? Lunch, you know, he probably doesn't go without dinner often, okay? Looking for a teenage boy, you know, teenage boys, they eat 8 times a day. But, you know, it's the idea that, yeah, you can enjoy something that's satisfying for the moment, but don't expect it to satisfy you permanently. And those are the things he keeps saying over and over here. Well, let's look what else he says in chapter 6 here, as he keeps sort of running through some of the same things. Can you read verse 7 to 9?
All the toil of a man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and striving after the wind.
Thank you. See how he's transitioning here very subtly in a way. He keeps talking about the lack of satisfaction with this life and its things, but he's also dropping in some perspective, even advice here. So what does he say here starting in verse 7? Hard work, hard labor does not equal what? Satisfaction. I mean, think about, I think our culture would, this would be so. I think our culture says if you work hard, you'll be a success and you'll be happy. But that's not what this says. Does that mean you don't work hard? No, no, no. We're going to see even other statements to say you need to be working hard. Like in chapter 9, he's going to talk about whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your mind. So don't listen to something he says and run in the wrong direction with it. Just soak up what he's saying in the moment. Hard work alone does not guarantee satisfaction. Now, we learn from Proverbs, if you don't work hard, there are going to be some problems that will set in. You know, poverty will set in and you'll have pain and frustration and all these kinds of things and hardship on yourself. The sluggard brings all kinds of pain on himself. But this is talking about, again, if you think you're going to be satisfied with working hard. Because think about this, Earl and I were talking about this a while ago. Think about this. What if the day comes when you can't work hard? Where does that leave you? Really, really frustrated. I think that's true with a lot of people, probably more men, that they're generally pretty satisfied because they can go out and do stuff and accomplish stuff and build stuff and tackle stuff, and then they get to the point where they can't. Then what do you do? So that's hard. That's really hard and frustrating. And actually, he'll get to that at the very end of the chapter, end of the book. So, look at verse 9. According to verse 9, and this is a little, he drops this in. We're going to see this in earnest in chapter 7 where he talks about the better. But what does he say is the key to having satisfaction in verse 9? What's better than what?
Like saying what you have is better than what you want.
Exactly right. What you eye is better than what you desire. What your eye can see that you possess is better than what you long for. So here's a person who has a modest house and modest clothing and a modest car, and they can look at it and say, I'm so blessed, I'm grateful for it, I want to enjoy it. And here's a person who's got an extravagant house and many nice cars and the best clothes, and they're like, ah, I just saw a house on the other side of the street that they've got something I don't have in my house. And they run down to get it, and they're out of it. It's on a ship coming from overseas, and it's stuck at a harbor, okay? And they're frustrated, and they go find another way to get it, and they have to pay 3 times the money to get it. And they run up, and they put it in their house, and then they look down the street, and somebody's got something else they don't have. So what you have is more satisfying than what you desire. And there you go. He's dropping this wisdom in on us here. And this man ought to know because he had it all. Okay. Yes. Right. Right. And he's going to talk about the wife in chapter 9 also, enjoying the wife of your youth. No, it's in chapter 9, yeah. Right, and there are different aspects of trying to keep up with the Joneses, whether it's money or possessions or, you know, sometimes people have competitions about their spouses or their children with other people. You know, we just had our second child. Oh, we got to have another child, you know. Or our child just did this. Oh, our child's got to get in that. They've got to become a karate champion. I mean, there's just so many different things, ways in which we can get pulled into that, including, like you say, even wandering eyes as far as, you know, spouses and so forth. Anyway, look at verses 10 to 12 as he's wrapping up this chapter. 10 to 12. Lori, will you read that?
Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun?
This is what I would call the pit of vanity. And what I mean by that is, I mean, like, geographically. I think this is his lowest point in the flow of the book of emphasizing the vanity of life. And there are three axioms here that he relates. One is, what's going to happen is what? Okay, we're all going to die. Yeah, he says that a lot, okay? And in verse 10, what's going to happen, regardless of what we think or do, is what?
Already happened.
It's going to happen. Okay? He is not able to speak with one stronger than he. In other words, we humans are going to hit walls. We're going to come up against forces that we can't control. Of course, ultimately, what's the force we can't control? Who is the force we can't control? God. Okay? The second axiom is there's nothing we can do about what happens once it happens. Okay? And the third one is, the more you look, the more vain things appear. He says in verse 11, the more words, the more vanity. Now, what does he mean by words? Well, as we see at the end of this book, he's going to talk about there's no end to the making of books. Here's a man who writes one of the greatest books ever in human history, who says at the end, there's sort of a vanity to writing books. Okay. Why write this? The point being is that the exercise of trying to figure out life is the benefit. And that exercise should drive us to God, because we can't figure it out. We got to put it in God's hands. That's the benefit of useless books. But the idea of words means I'm trying to talk my way through this. But the more words he uses, the more thinking he does, the deeper the vanity. He can't talk his way, he can't word his way, he can't think his way to a solution here. And this man is good at it. This man is good at thinking and reasoning and communicating and working through things, and he still ends up empty, okay? And I say one of the reasons why this might be what you would call the bottom of the pit of his view of the vanity of life is that he uses the expression vanity 22 times before this verse, the verses. He only uses it 11 times afterwards. So he's made his point. He's established the truth. And he'll refer back to it, but he's not hammering at it like he was. He's spreading out from it. And so this is sort of an interesting kind of juncture here. Okay. And look at the last question he poses in verse 12. For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life? Now, this is rhetorical, but he does sort of answer it. If life is empty, what good is it? If life is vain, is there any good in it? Well, maybe there are some good things. Or at least there are some things that are better than other things. They may not be as good as we would want them to be, but relatively, it's better to do this than to do that. And that's where he's going next. So let's go to chapter 12. I'm sorry, chapter 12. We're just looking at verse 12. Let's go to chapter 7. Okay. Let's lay this out right here in 14 verses. What is better? And watch how he goes all proverbial on us. Why do I say that? Look at the fifth, before you read anything in verse chapter 7, what pops out at you at the first 14 verses, or really 13 verses? It's set off. It's right. It's in verse. It's in poetic verse. These are the translators that did this, but they did it because that's what's written. It's these pithy little statements. So let's read what they say. Les, why don't you read that for us? 1 to 14, please.
A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men. And the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. For like the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of a fool. This also is vanity. Surely oppression destroys a man's reason, and a bribe debases the heart. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. Do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance and profit to those who see the sun. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. But the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him.
All right, thank you. All right, let's take these real quickly here. What's better than something else? First of all, first thing he says is what? What's better?
Yeah.
Or a good name. Yes. Good name is better than precious ointment. So this is very poetic here. What's a good name? What does that mean?
Reputation.
Your reputation. How do we get a good name? Life you live, the good life that you live,
character.
Your character, what you've manifested, as Jesus would say, your fruit. You know, it's possible to be perceived as having a good name and not have good character, but eventually a good name rises to the top, proves itself, and endures, and so forth. So look at this. In spite of the fact that life is vain, having good moral character matters. I mean, right? Isn't that one of the wrong lessons from this book? Is say, yep, I read the first two chapters of Ecclesiastes. Life is vain. I'm just going to go and just destroy myself. I'm just going to live an impure life, a foolish life, a destructive life, a law-breaking life, dishonest life, because I'm just going to do what I feel like doing. That's the wrong conclusion from this book. You can see why somebody would want to do that. What's the use anyway? Well, he asks a lot of questions. At the end of chapter 6, verse 12, for who knows what good is for man while he lives the few days of his life? Well, maybe there is some good to life, and it does matter how you go about it. What's the next good thing? He talks about this in verse 1 and 2, the end of verse 1 and also in verse 2. What else is better? This might be counterintuitive. The day of death or a time of mourning. Why? Especially, think very Ecclesiastes. Get in the tunnel of Ecclesiastes. Don't let yourself get too far out of Ecclesiastes. Why is the day of death or mourning better?
Yeah. You're getting away from this life under the sun.
Okay. The deliverance. There's that aspect. Has he said anything about death so far? What has he said about death? He says it back up in verse 6 of chapter 6 in earlier places. Man, just like the animals, what? The fool and the wise man will both die. It's that reality. The reality of death is a good thing. It's a good thing. Does it hurt? Is it painful? Does it rip your heart out? Yeah. But there's a benefit to it. And really stemming from that, verse 3, he says, what is better than what? sorrow better than laughter. We've already seen how he's tried fun and frolic and it's not satisfied, chapter 2. Here he says, sorrow is better than laughter. Why? Why is sorrow better than laughter?
It focuses you on what's more important.
It's a stripped down experience, isn't it? Your priorities change. You get focused on things differently. And hopefully the potential good in it is that you get focused on what's important. Sorrow is a cleanser. It's a purifier. Okay, I think it's G.K. Chesterton said, this is a little different. He says, getting in hot water is good for you. It keeps you clean. So experiences like that can be purifying, okay? And he says in verse 5, what is better? Very proverb-like, by the way. What's better in verse 5? A rebuke from a wise person, okay? Not just somebody being critical of you for some kind of, you know, terrible reason, but a rebuke from a wise person. It's better for a wise man to give you a rebuke, verse 4, than a fool to do what? Verse 5. Sing you a song. What do you think the song here means? This is not a country she left me and my life is a wreck song. This is a fun frolic song. It's entertainment. It's better to have a rebuke from a wise man than some fool try to sing you a song and put you in a good mood. Happy song, you know, I'm happy today or something like that. Sing it, maybe even singing your praises. Because in context, a rebuke or maybe a song of praise. Yeah. And he talks in verse 6 about the crackling of thorns under a pot. You have to understand, certainly today, but to some extent even in biblical times, the lack of foliage, vegetation, trees in Palestine, for what I understand, it's worse today than it was probably in ancient times for a lot of reasons. There are a lot of places like that on earth, like England. You know, they don't have a lot of forest left. But you know, we have a lot of wood, okay, in America, and we think of kindling. We think of, you know, I'm sure when Les does kindling, he has little slices that he's chopped up, you know, and thrown in there with paper. Can you imagine using thorns for kindling? Or to try to cook with thorns? So you cut thorns, you throw it under there. One thing for sure, they don't last long. They crack and they burn up and then they're gone real quickly. And that's the whole idea, is that laughter and songs, he talks about verse 6, so is the laughter of the fools. The fool will just have a good time. But that doesn't last. That doesn't really solve the problems. Okay? Not at all. But in light of all that, he says in verse 11 and 12, in spite of what he said over and over, the vanity of life, yet verse 11 and 12 tells us what? What is still a good thing?
Wisdom.
Yes, the fool and the wise man die. Yes, the wise man may take care of what he has and he leaves it to the fool. But there is still something beneficial about wisdom, okay? It's still a good thing. And I skipped one. I'm sorry. I skipped this. Back in verse 8, what's also better? Back in verse 8. I really, really messed up our timing. Sorry about that. What's better in verse 8? The end of a thing. Okay, think about this. The end of a thing is better than the beginning, the middle of it, three quarters of it. It's how it turns out, right? That's what matters. So that's telling us to be patient. And then what's the advice that he gives us in verse 9? Don't be what? Don't be quick in your spirit or quick to be angry. So think about it. Look how those two things together. Things are happening that are frustrating. Let it all unfold. Instead of reacting and getting mad about it, let it all work itself out. So here's my confession. For years I would go to my dad and we'd be talking and I didn't do this a lot, but occasionally I would share a frustration with him. Problem, an aggravation, a burden, and he would say, it'll all work out. That used to bother me. I get angry a little bit sometimes. I'm like, he's not really identifying with me. He's not really sympathizing. He's not really getting into my problem. He's just dismissing this. And I was one that was wrong. Almost all those things that I would talk to him about worked themselves out. And he knew that, being an experienced, wise, and godly person. Just let it work out. And I would get aggravated. Things like, I want him to identify with what I'm feeling, and I want him to give me some advice and tell me how to fix this, rather than just wait and let it work out. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not be quick in your spirit to become angry. There it is. So, there's a real need for patience and let it work itself out. That requires quite a bit of self-control, doesn't it? And restraint. And according to verse 10, what else can create impatience and anger in us?
Looking behind, looking back.
Right.
The good old days.
The good old days. So here's something in the moment that's aggravating you, and he's saying, let it work itself out. And then there are people who say, I'm in this moment, boy, things used to be so much better. According to the way he depicts this, that's not really a productive way of thinking. It aggravates us. Because guess what? You can't what? You can't go back. You can't go back. And what's the problem with that perspective often?
It's not true.
It's not accurate.
That's all you're remembering is the good old.
Right.
But it's also robbing you of the present.
It's robbing you of the present. The good. The enjoyment of the present. Exactly right. The good old days are not that good. Okay? Did somebody have a car issue this morning? Maybe it was not warm when you got in. Maybe you looked at it and, oh, I got to get an oil change or something. How would you like to go back to riding a horse and buggy this morning to come to Bible class and worship? Well, that'd be fun then, wouldn't it?
This morning wouldn't have been so bad. What if it's snowing and raining?
It's cool enough this morning, but what if it's raining or snowing or ice? Okay? So, I mean, come on. Good old days aren't that good in a lot of ways. And wow, what a way of thinking that he's given us here. So that's why, no wonder he says, and sorry I jumped ahead, no wonder he says, see, wisdom has an advantage. There is an advantage to wisdom. It's like a defense. Because he's given us wisdom, and then he says, see, wisdom's beneficial. He's been talking about all these betters. And then he comes back to this again, and we don't want to hear this. We don't want to hear this, but he comes right back at it again in verse 13 and 14. What is he teaching us in verse 13 and 14? Again. Whether it's a joyful day or a day of adversity, what about that day? God made them. God's in control. God's orchestrating things. We talked about this the other day. This was heavily emphasized in one of the earlier texts. Understand on the balance, humans still have choices. God doesn't make us do anything. Humans still have an incredible amount of free will. But when it comes to the circumstances of our lives and the unfolding of our lives, there are good times. There are bad times, and God's orchestrating everything. That we do have to resign ourselves to the ebb and flow of life and write them out. So when someone writes a play or a screenplay, then before they start performing it or filming it, what do the actors usually do, you think, with the script? They probably read it. You know, who's my character? I study, know my lines. I see this is going to happen and this is how it's going to turn out. Okay? Well, we're actors in a play, but we're not privy to the script. Now, I understand we know what we know about eternity, but life under the sun, We're not privy to the script. We got to be in the play, do the best we can, and see what's going to unfold before the curtain drops. We silly boys and girls, we think we're writing the story of our lives. How silly of us to think that. Life's going to unfold, and we're having to ride it out. But does it go anywhere? Ah, that's the key. Does it eventually go somewhere? And the rest of the Bible is answering that. It's telling us that it does go somewhere. And how we maneuver the ebb and flow has a big impact on that. Okay? It just happens. And then look at verse 15 to 22 of this section here. 15 to 22. Can you read that for us, Dave? 15 to 22.
I've seen everything during my lifetime of futility. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in his wickedness. Do not be excessively righteous and do not be overly wise. Why should you ruin yourself? Do not be excessively wicked and do not be a fool. Why should you die before your time? It is good for you to grasp one thing and also let go of the other. For the one who fears God comes forth with both of them. Wisdom strengthens the wise man more than 10 rulers who are in a city. Indeed, there is no righteous man on earth who continually does good and then never sins. Also, do not take seriously all the words which were spoken so that you will not hear your servant cursing you. For you also are realized that you likewise have many times cursed others.
All right, thank you. I think, and we're probably not going to get to all this chapter here in a couple minutes, but this is probably one of the more challenging sections of the book, I think. We'll cover the last part Wednesday night. But let's look at this here. Take this piece by piece, and I'll just lay out what I think is being said here. Verse 15 strikes again the note of the vanity of life. So remember, that's got to overshadow everything. And he talks about righteousness, wisdom, wickedness, and foolishness. And he's saying, don't be what? Regarding righteousness, wisdom, wickedness, and foolishness. Don't be what? Don't be overly those things. Okay, what is this about? Okay, remember how we looked at the word evil before? Okay? He's not saying that righteousness and wisdom have limited value. Yeah, you need to be a little wise. Now, come on. He's just been writing about the value of wisdom, right? So he's not saying that. And he's just written about good character. You know, you want to sort of have a good reputation, but not a really great reputation. He's not saying that, okay? He's not endorsing wickedness and foolishness to a degree. You know, like there's a scale here, okay? Here's the point. On trying to be wise, don't think that's going to satisfy your life. He's tried that. And certainly being foolish, that's not going to satisfy you. And being wicked is not going to satisfy you. And don't think that somehow you can so make yourself into such a righteous person that you'll be satisfied in this life. Now, I think righteousness here, because of what it said in verse 18, has to do with what maybe a Pharisee, who doesn't exist at this time, by the way, but the mentalities do. It's the idea that I'm going to be such a good person. I'm going to have a clean track record, and I'm going to be different than everybody else, and thus I'm going to be better than everybody else. And so it's the idea of trying to make yourself righteous and thus conquer and find satisfaction in life. I think that's what he's getting at. Because in verse 18, almost in contrast to those statements, he says, it's good that you should take hold of this, and from that withhold not your hand, for the one who fears God shall come out from both of them. Think about how often the New Testament teaches we are justified by faith We rely on God. We trust God. We depend on God. We're justified by faith, not by our own works. We can't earn a good life, but we can place ourselves in God's hand, accept His blessings as gifts, and enjoy a good life. So the fact that he talks about fearing God indicates that you're not living a life of, you know, like a reprobate, okay? But you're putting your life in the hand of God, into His control. You're fearing and trusting and leaning on Him. That's what you need to do instead of trying to figure out some path to satisfy yourself. It's in God. I think that's what he's writing about. Okay, we'll talk about the end of the chapter on Wednesday nights and night and move on to chapter 8. Thank you.